Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Well, good morning. Here we are, and it's a little bit of a dreary day in Atlanta after frigid cold all across the country. But we're excited today because we have really a great guest for you to hear his experiences and the things that he's doing. His name is Dr. Randy Ross. He is the Chief Enthusiasm Officer.
There you go.
Yeah. Officer for his company. And he also has written a book and has a number of different things that is going to help us think about how to be remarkable in year 2014. So, Dr. Ross, welcome this morning.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. So, even before we get started in some of those various aspects that we want to talk to our listeners today, why don't you talk to us a little bit about your background and just tell us a little bit about the organization that you're the Chief Enthusiasm Officer of.
Okay. Well, from a brief high-flying level, my background is interesting in the fact that I was in ministry in the not-for-profit realm for many years, about 20 years early in my career. I have a doctorate in theology. And so had the opportunity to as I pastored churches across the Southeast, get involved in stepping into boardrooms across my span of influence, and had more and more executives ask me to come into their environments and coach their teams. And love that, fell in love with the opportunity to help people experience their better self. Mm-hmm. And so made the transition from the pulpit into the marketplace and began to work with some organizations that had a real desire to craft their culture in a way that would highly engage their people. Had a chance to work with a couple of organizations along those lines and saw some great cultural development. Organizations that had struggled before with the human element really began to turn things around and launch a new trajectory, and had a passion for that, so decided to step out and develop our own consulting and advisory group that works now in multiple verticals to help organizations address this issue of how do we engage our people in such a way that they bring their very best to the table every single day. And that's what Remarkable is all about. So taking that whole inspirational side, as well as helping people define their values, and then beginning to see their passion and their strengths lived out in the marketplace so that they can truly leave a lasting positive mark wherever they go.
Great. So I would be remiss if I didn't pick up on something that you said in your intro. So you started out, you said you have a doctorate in theology. How difficult or how easy was it for you to make sort of that transition, even though it sounds like you bring a lot of those same kind of principles into the corporate world that you work at? Because a lot of times our listeners are thinking about transitions and how do they shift between something maybe that they're doing today that has a connection to something they want to do tomorrow. So can you tell us a little bit about that, a little bit more about that evolution?
Sure. Well, I think for me, it was a very natural evolution. So you have a lot of people in the marketplace who are industrial organizational psychologists, and they're constantly reminding us that people, you need to tap into the passion of your people in order for them to bring their best to work. And we talk about structure and design and all the operational and tactical things that need to be put into place in order for people to function efficiently. And so we spend most of our educational days trying to create our skill sets, our quiver of arrows, as it were. And I think that's very important. You've got to be able to refine your skill sets and bring knowledge and expertise to the table. But the reality is that most people either flounder or they flourish, not on their skill sets, but upon their emotional balance. Are they able to emotionally balance the issues of life? So dealing with issues like stress, balancing family life and work life, trying to find a place where they can solidly stand on their values and be able to sustain high performance over the long haul. Because in every organization, you have high achievers, but you, as well as many other business professionals, have seen people who were high-flying, successful producers who crash and burn, right? And there's a reason for that. It's not that they're not highly skilled. It's that they had an inability to manage life in such a way that they could sustain that performance over the long haul. So from the standpoint of theology, you're obviously talking about values. You're talking about inspirational concepts. You're talking about being able to see a life from a different perspective, from a divine perspective, of course. But part of what that has to do with and what that speaks to is resilience, optimism, faith, the ability to deal with life's difficulties and to balance and juggle life while maintaining a strong commitment to your core values. Because here's kind of an interesting tidbit. Stress is exacerbated when you're not living life out according to your values. All of us have a value construct, right? And so when we're living consistent with our values, with our value construct, we're invigorated. We're energized in our work. We're impassioned. We're creative. We have a better means to be collaborative. When we're living against our value construct, and that's one reason I think that there's so many people in the marketplace today that are dissatisfied and disgruntled with the work that they're currently doing. And maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, engagement scores overall.
Sure.
But a big part of that is that people are doing work inconsistent with their personal values.
Right. So how did you come up with the title of Remarkable as the name of your company, but also, you know, sort of the brand for the work that you deliver?
Great question. So we wanted to put the message out in the marketplace in a form that was easily accessible. So we took a lot of the principles and concepts that we've been teaching for years, things that we've learned and we've seen other companies incorporate into a great cultural environment where they have high levels of engagement. And I guess it all started with a quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes. And he said that nothing is so commonplace as the wish to be remarkable. Everybody wants to be remarkable. Mm. I mean, when you're remarkable, you leave a positive wake in your world. You know, you make a difference. You mark people's lives in a way that's not easily erased. We all want to make a positive difference wherever we go. The challenge is very, very few people know really how to do that. Mm. And very few people do that intentionally. It's interesting on a corporate level. That should be the primary focus of every organization. Another interesting quote is by Robert Stevens. Robert Stevens, you may remember, is the founder of Geek Squad. Well, in October of 2004, he made a comment in an interview, and he said this: advertising is the tax you pay for being unremarkable. Because if you're remarkable, think about it. By its very definition, people are doing what?
They're going to know who you are, and they're going to be trying to get what you have and understand how they might be able to use it. I love this. What you just said is to leave a positive wake. So if we have some leaders out there that, you know, that resonates with them and they are thinking about how, particularly since we're at the beginning of the new year, how they can have a more positive impact on the culture within their organizations, you know, sort of think about either a current client that you're working with or maybe a recent client and maybe get a little bit more specific about how you help these leaders in these organizations become remarkable by this engagement and improving performance.
I'd love to. Okay, now you're trying to get me to the punchline here, aren't you?
No.
Can I back up for just
a
second?
Let me
frame this and just say this. That's a great question because so many companies are unremarkable. You know, back to this comment by Robert Stevens, if you're remarkable, people are remarking about you.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about you. They're telling your story. Sometimes in workshops and conferences, what I do is I ask the audience, I'll say, name for me the companies that you believe are remarkable. And I'll get 4 or 5 or 6, maybe 10. You know, if I'm talking to an audience of 300 people, there are 10 companies that pretty readily rise to the top immediately. And so we'll field those and write them on the board. And then it begins to flounder. And we might get to 12, maybe sometimes 15. But then I ask the follow-up questions. How many companies are there in the world?
Millions and millions and millions.
And you've only been able to identify quickly 15 or so, less than 15, that you believe to be remarkable. Now think about that.
Yeah. Can I, as you're telling us a little bit more on context, the thing that sort of is in my mind could we also back up and, for our listening audience, give an idea of sort of how do you characterize remarkable? Is that something that is sort of defined by each client, or do you have sort of a core set of principles or ideas that say these principles are sort of need to be present in order to be a remarkable company?
This is what makes you remarkable. Absolutely. Yeah. And what we say is you have to find remarkable. You have to find your remarkable, because there's no one formula, but there are some questions that you can ask. And if you answer those questions in the affirmative, you're well on your way to becoming remarkable. And we're going to get around to those in just a minute, but I'm going to leave you hanging, okay?
Okay, all right, no problem.
Because we will get there. But there are five questions that if you ask those five questions and you can answer them with yes, then you're on the way to becoming remarkable. But so few people are. And that's the sad part of it. So you probably already know this, but engagement plays a heavy part in whether or not a company is remarkable. That's one of the measures that we use. We want to find out, you know, do your people bring passion, excitement, enthusiasm, creativity to the work experience? And the answer is most of them don't. As a matter of fact, research over the last two decades that the Gallup organization has published has given us a very sobering, eye-opening view into the condition of the American workforce. And they tell us, based upon their research, that only 30% of the American workforce is what they would consider to be engaged. In other words, they're emotionally attached to the work experience.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about this idea of engagement, because actually just yesterday I was talking with a client and they actually do surveys to measure the level of engagement. And this was a particular leader who had a challenge with one particular aspect of that. And it was very interesting that sort of the approach was, let's have someone come in, talk to people, find out exactly what it is, and then maybe we can do a training course or we can do something to resolve it. I would imagine it's, you and I both know it's a little bit more challenging and a different perspective that you have to take if you really want true engagement.
Yeah.
So how do you work with clients to help them kind of go beyond that superficial, we just want everybody to sort of be able to check the right box on a survey so that we can have a high score?
Well, and I'm glad you bring that up, because unfortunately that's how a lot of organizations do measure their engagement, and their remediation efforts therefore fall a little bit short in terms of how to get their people more actively involved and passionate about what they do. So think about that for just a second. If a third of the American workforce is engaged, that leaves over 52% of what Gallup calls not engaged, meaning that they're just punching a time clock, right? They're showing up for work. They're exchanging their time for money, but they have no real passion. In other words, when they wake up on Monday morning, when the alarm goes off, their attitude is, good God, it's Monday.
Right.
Rather than, God, it's going to be a good Monday, right? And so when the vast majority of the workforce wakes up and thinks about work in that frame of mind, you're not going to get the very best from them. And then Gallup goes on to say that at least 18% of the American workforce is actively disengaged, meaning that they're so disillusioned, they're so disenfranchised, that they are actively looking to go somewhere else. And they would even go on to say that 3% of the people in your organization could possibly be described as onboard terrorists, meaning that they're actively trying to bring down the present regime. Now think about that in terms of lost productivity. So if I were the captain of a rowing team and I had 10 people on my team in my boat and I'm up front, you know, sounding the cadence, that means if you use that same statistic, that if you compared it to the American workforce, only 3% would be rowing with all their might in sync with my cadence, me making the calls as the leader. Five of those team members would only be rowing hard at the oar every other stroke. The rest of the time, they're kind of looking back and taking in the scenery, right? And you've got at least two of those people on the row team who not only are not rowing, but their oars are dragging in the water and their feet are probably dangled over the side of the boat as well.
All right.
And that means that leaders have a real challenge on their hands. to get their people to a place where they're satisfied, where they're fulfilled, where they're excited, where they literally have a strong emotional attachment to the work that they do. And that's what Remarkable is all about. And so it's an important message, we believe, that needs to be permeated throughout the marketplace. And we're excited about the reception that we've received so far.
Right. So as you've been doing your coaching and your consulting work, you know, just if I were to sort of summarize what I've gotten, a lot of these principles or a lot of these ideas, you're seeing them, leaders being challenged by them. And you have been able to sort of organize those ideas in a book form. And why don't we talk a little bit about sort of how you decided that for your Remarkable organization, writing a book was something that sort of would help you as well as your clients.
Sure. So we wanted to take a lot of the principles and concepts that we've learned and we've studied through the years and put them in a simple to understand narrative form. And that's what we did. So we've told a story, and in the story is interwoven all these principles and concepts of axiology. Now, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I'll just tell you that the vast majority of people have no clue what axiology is.
So why don't we tell them?
So let's tell them. So axiology is actually the study of values and value constructs. A simple way to put it is it's the way someone views the world. It's their perspective on life and work. And it's the ability to measure good, good being defined as someone's ability to fulfill their potential. It comes from the field of philosophy, and the father of modern axiology is a fellow by the name of Dr. Robert Hartman. And Dr. Hartman did a lot of work in this field of values and being able to measure values, because he was not only a philosopher, but he was a scientist and he was a mathematician, a true Renaissance man. And so he did a lot of work in this whole area of axiology, and we wanted to take some of those profound, albeit complex, ideas and thoughts that can sometimes get a bit ethereal, and we wanted to boil them down to their essence and be able to state them clearly in a format that would be helpful to people. And I think that's what we've been able to do in this book.
Before we again, talk a little bit about some of those questions and the principles that are in the book. Some of our listeners are consultants, and you know, many consultants do a lot of keynote speaking. They do they write books to support the work that they're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about the book writing process, and maybe even what's a lesson learned that you got from it that might be helpful for somebody that's embarking upon that in 2014?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, it's a challenging and daunting task to write a book. Coming up with the ideas is the first part, and that's the launch pad. But there's so much that needs to take place in order to fuel that rocket to get it off the ground. But one of the blessings and the benefits of writing this particular book for me was the opportunity I had to co-author it with a friend of mine. So as I was thinking through writing the book, beginning to get the narrative fleshed out and all the principles that we wanted to include in the book, one of the principles that I wanted to include in the book was I had heard a friend of mine deliver in a workshop. And so I went to him and I said, hey, I'd love to know how to give you proper credit for this. So how can I do that? Or better yet, hey, David, would you consider co-authoring this book with me? And he got excited. And so we together were able to write the book. And obviously when David came into the process, we had a chance to go back and massage all the material and add so much content to it, and it became so much more rich and fluid.
Let me just make sure you say David. Mm-hmm. For our listening audience, can you give his full name and sort of the connection there?
David Salyers is a friend of mine. We live in the same neighborhood. We've gotten to know each other through the years. And David is the vice president of marketing for a little chicken sandwich company here in Atlanta called Chick-fil-A.
Mm. I've heard of them.
Have you heard of them?
Yeah, I have.
They have a great, great lunch menu. Their new salads are really good, too. But David and I got excited about this because we were able to take some of the concepts and principles that both he and I have seen in the marketplace demonstrated through some very unusual corporate settings, some remarkable organizations. And so we had fun deepening our friendship and coming up with the content of the book. And I think two are better than one when it comes to creative ability to put something down on paper. And so the whole process was fun to begin with. It was lengthy and challenging and daunting, but fun because I was doing it with a friend.
How long did it take you all from sort of once you decided you were going to start a book to when you were able to get it published?
Well, the writing process, the idea phase, came pretty quickly. That's typically what you see in a book because you've got a lot of content that you want to get on paper. It's the refinement process that's challenging because we probably rewrote the book in different portions of chapters 150 times just because we wanted to get it right and wanted it to be clear and we had better ideas. And so I don't think the process of writing a book is ever complete. You just have to stop at some point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so what's something you learned about yourself through that process, the decision to make to write the book and then bring it to fruition? Did you have any key lessons learned as a leader?
Well, I think so. I think that I've learned a lot when it comes to communicating with people that less is more, to try to state complex principles in a simple sort of a way, challenged by the statement that Einstein made. He said, any fool can take something simple and make it complex through convolution and misdirection, but it takes a measure of genius to take those things that are complex and articulate them clearly and simply. And I see a lot of business leaders, frankly, between the two of us who are out there who are making the very simple complex. And it frustrates people.
Sure.
And I think the best leaders are those that are able to take complex ideas and articulate them clearly and simply, unencumbered, so that their people can grasp them and absorb them.
So we're going to ask you to walk the walk and talk the talk a little bit on that. So I'm sure many of our listeners are saying, you know, remarkable. I'm thinking about that book and it might be something that would help me. But if we wanted to give sort of, we've talked a lot about sort of the principles around it, but if we wanted to give some nuggets that says, you know, here's some of those key ideas that maybe brings this concept to life in sort of that succinct, in a nutshell, really crystal clear way, can you give our listeners a snapshot of kind of what's in the book and how it might apply?
Yeah, so we, in the book, in the midst of this narrative, this business executive called Dusty Hartz, he's having a trouble with his team around the area of engagement. And so as he's driving home one afternoon, his clutch in his car begins to go out. And so he takes it into a local car care place. And there his friend, Fred Walters, that he's grown to know through the years, works on his car. And as the story unfolds, and I'll not rob it of all the twists and turns, but Fred becomes his mentor. And Fred was a former high-flying business executive who was a turnaround expert and really knew how to engage people. So as the narrative unfolds, Dusty is learning from Fred these principles or these maxims of value creation. And so there are five questions, we'll get to that, that a person can ask to get themselves well on the way of becoming a remarkable person. And the first one is this. The first question you can ask is, are you creating value?
Define value for our listeners' audience. We use that word all the time.
Yeah, we do. So we talk about creating value, bringing value, value add. It's almost become rhetoric in the marketplace. You know, we're going to add value. Mm-hmm. The problem is very few people truly know how to do that because, simply put, in any endeavor, you have one of two choices. Either you're going to create and bring value to that endeavor, or you're going to seek to position yourself to extract value from that endeavor. And many, many, many people think that when they're bringing value, what they're actually doing is extracting value. So let me give you a case in point. A lot of sales training and sales techniques encourage their salespeople to go out, and you have to give before you can ask. You have to give to get. But everybody's familiar with that tactic. So when you employ that tactic, you give to get, the person on the other side knows that you're eventually going to call in that marker. Mm-hmm. You're eventually going to call in that chip. that all you've done is just prep the ground for the big ask, right? And so it's disingenuous. Everybody knows the game that's being played. Rather than going into that setting to say, I'm going to give to you, I'm going to try to find out what your challenges, your needs are, and I'm going to try to provide for you the very best solution I can provide, even if it's through another provider. But I'm going to give to you exclusively. And we do a little fun thing in our workshop where we give people an opportunity to go through an exercise. And the exercise is pretty simple. It gives them a chance either to compete or collaborate. Hmm. Guess what they do 99% of the time?
Compete.
They compete.
Right.
Now, anytime you compete, that's value extraction. Anytime you collaborate, that's value creation. So the way you define value creation is, do you bring more to the table than you take away?
Hmm. So value creation is one of those key principles. What is a few other things that maybe connect to those questions that our listening audience can be thinking about? Am I on my way to being remarkable?
Yeah. So I want to give you the second one here in just a minute. But if I can hang on that whole concept, first of all, of just creating value, if you think about it in a relational context, here's a great way to position it. Let's say with your significant other, your husband, your wife, or someone that you're dating. If you make more emotional deposits into that person's life or into that relationship, then you make emotional withdrawals, you're going to be rich in that relationship because you're going to accumulate an abundance of positive. On the other hand, in that relationship, if you make emotional withdrawals from that relationship, more emotional withdrawals than you make deposit, what's going to happen?
Yeah, you're at a deficit, and that's not exactly creating value.
You're going to deplete the account. You're at a deficit. You're eventually going to be emotionally and relationally bankrupt. And we see that in the world around us all the time.
Sure.
In personal life, in business, you see organizations that are trying to get their people to gel and come together, but they can't because they have no emotional bank account to draw from. They've already depleted whatever emotional energy should and could have been there had they made deposits collectively together. But their relationships are emotionally bankrupt. That's why you have people like Covey talking about the speed of trust and why trust is so important in organizational life, because most organizations are emotionally bankrupt because you have people who are positioning themselves and competing against each other, even internally, for the same resources.
Sure, sure.
Which is crazy. Because what an organization should do is look across the enterprise and they should collectively decide, okay, this year we have the greatest opportunity to produce the most or create the most value in this area, and everyone should rally to support and fund that area for the benefit of everybody. But what happens in most budget proposal situations?
Right. It creates more of a turf situation because I've got to protect what my budget is to get done whatever it is that I feel is on my priority list.
You got it. And so what are they doing? They're competing for limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than placing those limited resources where those resources can do the most good and move the entire organization forward. So you have territorialism and you have silos being created and people fighting internally. And it happens all the time.
Right.
Rather than thinking holistically. So to answer your question, here's the whole key. When you enter into any endeavor, is it about me or is it about we?
Mm-hmm. And if you were going to give, again, you mentioned that all of these things in terms of how you as a leader and your organization become remarkable, you've got to figure out what those things are. But, you know, this issue of people rallying around to be value creators and focusing on the we is a simple concept but sometimes difficult to implement. So if you could give us one nugget that might be a principle that I could think about, how should that work its way through my organization?
Yeah.
What would that be to kind of create more of that we sense?
Yeah, that we sense. It gets back to that question. Are you bringing more to the table than you're taking away? No organization can advance if everybody's seeking to take off the table as much as they bring. The organization, the team, the endeavor can't move forward until there is more on the table after everybody leaves than there was before they came there.
Okay.
And so the first question we ask is, are you personally and are you as a team creating value? The second question is equally important, and it's a great question for even accountability, but it's, are you leaving a positive wake? And that's what you referred to a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is we all know people when they move through their world who leave a negative wake, right? Those are the folks that when you come into the office and you see them walking down the hallway, you just kind of want to dive into the bathroom or into the break room, right, so that you can avoid them, because every time you're around them, you just feel drained. You know, they complain, they're naysayers, you know, they're victims, nothing's ever going right, the world is bad, it's dreary. And those are people who you walk away from those conversations, you just want to wash your hands, right?
Right.
You just feel ugly and nasty, and you just feel depleted. There are other people, in the way they move through their world, they just light up the room. When they leave, people are glad they came by, as opposed to glad they're gone.
Right, and any business owner or manager would like to have those that want to leave that positive wake. What do you tell a leader? You know, so there's, you know, one principle I know from just individual change: you cannot change other people, right?
Yep.
People have to decide that they want to change. So for that leader that has some people that grasp the remarkable concept, really want to make that happen, and then they have some people that, although they've been exposed to it and principally they understand it, you know, intellectually, it's just not something that at this time they are able to create that kind of behavior. What do you tell that leader that really is trying to embody this throughout their organization? Because that's where some of the challenges come in.
Absolutely. And that's why our work is so important and so rewarding and thrilling, because nothing of long-lasting positive value will ever happen by force. It won't. And you see a lot of leaders out in the marketplace that are trying to beat their workforce into a different way of thinking, right? And it's never going to happen, because people are the product of their choices, and people will always fall back to their ability to make their own decision. So you can structure things, you can put together performance enhancement plans and all kind of incentive programs to get people to behave differently through extrinsic motivation. But the reality is, as soon as that motivation is gone, if that's the boss, as soon as the boss leaves the room, they're all going to revert back to what they want to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as that motivational factor is present, behavior may change, but it's always short-lived. So what you have to do is you have to help your people grow in their value construct, help them see a different way, and inspire them to new heights and new levels.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, when you are working with clients or a potential client who sees the value of what you're talking about, but clearly you're talking about making investments. And from a leadership perspective, that takes time and energy to create this kind of environment. What would you say to the business owner that, again, is on board intellectually with it, but from a standpoint is not really clear how you find the time and the resources to be able to make this shift? Because I think a lot of times it's not for, you know, I think of myself as a business owner. There's a lot of principles and a lot of things I know would make my business better, and or that I can talk to my clients, because I do consulting, to help them. But a lot of it is time and investment sometimes holds people back. So what do you say to that leader to help them sort of get into a different mode of thinking about their time and how they're investing and building culture?
Yeah, great question, because you already touched on it. You said, how do you find the time and invest the resources necessary? Well, you don't find it. You make it. And again, it's a value. Whatever I deem to hold high value, I will pursue wholeheartedly. Those things that I think are valuable, I'm going to invest in. And if I believe that the culture of my organization really is the only true differentiating factor we have as an organization, then I'll invest the time to make it different and make it better. Here's the challenge, is that most people don't think intentionally about crafting their culture. And here's what I say. You're gonna have a culture.
Right. It's
and it's either going to be by design or it's going to be by default.
Mm-hmm.
You're either going to invest the time and energy to make it better, you know, find the time, find the resources, and focus your attention on that. Or one of these days you're going to wake up and you're going to have a culture by default, and you're going to look around and go, I don't like this place. I don't care for these people. I don't want to be here, and I'm not really excited about coming to work tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And you actually see a lot of people waking up in relationships like that because they never intentionally invested in making the relationship better. Because the culture is nothing more than the values, beliefs, and behaviors that drive the organization.
So if I am committed, because again, I want to make sure that we leave our listeners with one or two things that they could do tomorrow after listening to this broadcast and think differently when they come Monday morning and actually do something different. What would you say is sort of that first micro step that could help them make a tangible difference?
It's real simple. If you want the silver bullet, here it is. Decide to become remarkable. Hmm. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's as easy as a choice.
Okay.
It is the way that you decide you're going to interact with your world. Today, I mean, how many people do you think woke up this morning and said, today I'm going to make it a remarkable day. Today I'm going to be remarkable. What would happen if we made a commitment that in every encounter, every person we meet, every opportunity we have, every crisis we confront, we're going to make the remarkable choice. We're going to make a choice to be remarkable. I'm going to make the decision that in this conflict, in this situation, in this opportunity, I'm going to move in such a way that when I leave the room, people are going to shake their head and go, wow.
What happened?
What happened there?
Right.
That was cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That, what he did, what he said, how he conducted himself in the face of even that, you know, whatever, that challenge, that was extraordinary. That was remarkable. What if everything I did today, or better yet, what if everything you did for the next 7 days left such a positive mark on other people's lives that when you left the room, they shook their head and just said, wow.
So I'm assuming, tell me if my assumption is incorrect, that obviously you understanding these principles and the passion that clearly you have for this topic, what are some of your challenges that keeps you from, even though you've made the decision to be remarkable, maybe give our listeners how you've overcome when, you know, you perform less than remarkable yesterday.
Which happens every day.
Yesterday, and you want to, you know, make a shift or a pivot. How do you work through that? Because the principles, I would imagine, for you are pretty ingrained in terms of knowing what they are. Now it's a matter of execution. How do you deal with that difference?
Well, remember, everybody, there's nothing so common as the wish to be remarkable.
Absolutely.
And I wish to be remarkable, too. But I fall short of that every day. Here's the key. Every day, in every decision, ask yourself, number one, am I creating value? That's the first question. Am I creating value in this situation? Am I bringing more to the table than I'm taking away?
Okay.
I want that to happen in every encounter. Number two, am I leaving a positive wake? Are the people that I leave behind better off because I was there? Right? That's the second question. The third question is equally important because the third question is, what problem are you solving? Now, this is crucial and this is critical. What do most people do when a problem arises?
Well, they start problem solving and they try to see if they can figure out what is either creating it or a solution. Maybe
right.
Sometimes they jump to solution that they say, this is what I think is going to solve it.
Yeah, a lot of times they do, particularly in corporate team settings. But oftentimes my experience has been when a problem comes to the table, the first thing people move to is blame shifting.
Mm.
In other words, when they're trying to solve the problem, who's responsible for it? Whose fault is it that we're here? Not how can we fix it or what do we need to do? But it's usually casting aspersions and trying to remove themselves emotionally from the fray of the problem. And we say the best way to create value, getting back to that first question, are you creating value? Are you bringing more to the table than you're taking away? The best way to do that is to find a problem and solve it.
Okay.
Not just daily, but as a career. If you want to be impassioned for your, you know, for your career, then find a problem. And you apply your passion and your strengths and apply your values to solve that problem, and you'll have a career that will be not only invigorating, but one you'll never want to retire from.
So that's number three, if I'm counting correctly.
Yeah.
What am I creating value? Mm-hmm. Am I
leaving a positive
wake? Am I
solving a problem?
What's number four?
Yeah. Well, so now we're getting down to the crux of it. And as we get further past the third one, can I park there for just a second?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of times what happens is in people's careers, they just sort of, much like no emphasis upon design, but by default. A lot of people get in their careers by default.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, they go to college, they garner knowledge and skill sets, and they get out, and what do? They interview for their first job, and what job do they normally take?
Well, the one that's a lot of times the first one that's offered.
First one that's offered or the one that pays the most, mm-hmm. right? And so they fall into that, whether it's really what they wanted to do or not, or whether it's really even with the company they wanted to work for or not. It had nothing to do with their values. It had nothing to do with their passion. It had very little to do with their strengths. In many cases, it had to do with who's going to pay me the most. And it's backwards thinking. And so what happens is people get out trying to make as much money as they can because the idea is, I want to make as much money as I can so I can retire by the age of 35. I mean, how many of us went into the marketplace with that kind of an expectation? And then all of a sudden we hit 35 and it didn't happen and we got disillusioned. So, you know, we're struggling in this career that we really aren't happy and enjoying doing, but we got to do it to make more money to support our standard of living rather than from the very beginning say, where can I use my passion and my strengths to solve the biggest problem? Where can I find a company that aligns with my values, where I can invest myself and enjoy what I'm doing for a lifetime? I can't help but think about the statement that Truett Cathy, who you may know as the founder of sure. Chick-fil-A. Well, Truett's now 92 years old. He still comes in the office every single day in his coat and tie. You know, someone recently in jest said, you know, Truett, why do you do this? I mean, last time I checked, your retirement account was fully funded. Why are you still coming into the office? And his question was profound. He said, why would I not do what I love to do? Mm-hmm. And he went on to say, find something you love to do and you'll never work another day in your life.
Okay.
I love that because you know, kids getting out of school these days, they're looking to find something to do for a season of time so they can make a lot of money and retire. But what does that say? I'm going to work hard so that one day I don't have to do what I don't want to do anymore? Yeah, we need to look at it differently. What can I find that will captivate my attention for a lifetime that I do wake up every morning and go, God, this is a great day?
Okay. Right?
So back to those questions. The first question is, am I creating value?
Mm-hmm.
Am I bringing more to the table than I'm taking away? Number two, am I leaving a positive wake? Number three is, help me out. You remember number three?
What problem am I trying to solve?
That's right. What problem am I trying to solve? And number four is, am I taking responsibility to move things in a positive direction?
Right. And so we have a little bit of time. I want to make sure we get to the fifth one, and then I want to ask you about actually something you brought into the studio audience so you can give our listeners a little bit about, I don't know if it has a
sure.
formal name, but the Remarkable Box.
Yeah.
So what's the fifth principle?
The fifth one ties it all together, and it's, are you making the superior choice?
Okay.
And the superior choice is a tie-in to the book, and as you read the book, you'll understand all of that and how that fleshes itself out. But the superior choice is to create value and inspire hope. In everything that I do, am I creating value, and am I inspiring hope? And so that's the whole thrust of Remarkable. And again, leaders can challenge their workforce to be remarkable. Individuals need to challenge themselves on a daily basis. Am I moving in a remarkable way? Am I leaving a mark on my world that's not easily erased?
Yeah, so one of the things I've taken from sort of the overview that you've provided is a first step I could do, you know, starting tomorrow even, is when I wake up, ask myself those questions and see what does that mean for what I want to create today. And at the end of the day, I could ask myself those same questions from a backward-looking perspective that said, how well did I do that, and what changes might I make? And so really I'm taking away is understanding those five core questions. It's as simple as being more intentional in what you do as an individual and as a leader, and then sort of holding yourself accountable to that. Is that a fair?
It is.
Great.
It is.
Great.
It's simple in its construct.
Yeah.
More challenging to apply.
Yeah.
But if we would do that, if we wake up every day and say, I'm going to be remarkable, make a choice to be remarkable today, what does that look like?
Yeah.
And ask yourself those five questions, you'd be well on your way.
Great. So it's not often that when I have a guest, they bring me a gift, and so I appreciate that. And I want you to tell our listening audience a little bit about the Remarkable Box. So you can't see this, our listeners, but there's a nice box that Dr. Ross has provided that has some goodies inside that would help me be more remarkable. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of that and how you use those in your clients and the nonprofit connection. I love that part.
Sure, would love to. And even while we're talking, if your listening audience would like to go to remarkablemovement.com, they can actually see the box and hear a little bit about the story of the box. But David and I, back October, so we were thinking, how could we support a friend of ours who's actually found a problem and he started to solve it? He's applying the principles of the book. And to give you a little bit of his story, his name is Brian, and Brian Preston founded a group called Layman Luther. And Brian was working for an advertising agency. He was introduced to a group of homeless men out in the woods of Douglasville. They were literally living in a tarp community. And so Brian befriended them and took them food and clothing. And one day he was sitting around talking with them, and he said, you know, what more can I do for you guys? And one of them looked at him and said, Brian, we appreciate your handouts, but we really want a job.
Hand up.
We really want that. And so Brian was thinking, and he was formerly in construction, and he thought, well, I could easily get warehouse space, and I've got some tools that I could, you know, bring to the table. So he hired these guys one at a time out of the woods and started taking them with him to do some remodeling projects. And eventually what it morphed into was now an organization named after his grandfather, Layman Luther, where they take recycled wood, reclaimed wood, and they build beautiful furniture. We asked Brian if he would consider the possibility of making us a box that we could put our book in and we could give away to friends and clients at Christmas. And so he did. We came up with several different designs and finally landed on this one that you see on the table. And so love the story because it's helping to get homeless craftsmen literally into a position where they can earn a livelihood. And we're sharing with a couple of our groups that we do some work with, some of our clients, and they loved it. And so they've picked up on it, and they've started giving it away at closings and as client appreciation gifts and the like. But we continued to think it through, and one of the things that we were encouraged to craft was what was called a seven-day challenge. And so now we have the Remarkable Seven-Day Challenge. And the Remarkable Seven-Day Challenge is a series of envelopes that you open one every day, and there's a challenge there to do something remarkable that will leave a positive wake in your world. It's a simple gesture of warm-hearted goodwill, good deeds to create goodwill. And it's fun because the challenge itself will literally change your environment. You will positively impact other people's lives, and the best part is in the process, it will change your life.
So if my listening audience is intrigued by that, because, again, I think that that gives them something that if these concepts really are something that are sparking them to become more remarkable, it gives them a pathway.
Sure.
So can you give our listening audience the website again so that if they want to see the box and they want to understand a little bit more about the challenge, I would imagine they can go to that website?
Absolutely, yeah. So remarkablemovement.com, and there are all kinds of resources that you can get access to. The book is there. The challenge is there. The box is there. You can buy them individually or you can buy it all bundled together. But a lot of organizations purchase them as Christmas gifts during this last season. But a lot of other organizations are purchasing the boxes for their team members to make 2014 remarkable.
Yeah, I was about to say, when I do facilitations, a lot of times you're thinking about, in connection to what you're doing, is there something that you can do that's a leave behind? Because I think, again, one of the things that I'm taking away from the conversation is the principles are there, but and then you have to make the commitment, and then you have to have something that's going to every day allow you to reinforce that commitment. And so this Remarkable Box is a way to help people get started on that journey.
It really is. And in the front cover of the challenge, if I could just read a little
sure.
bit over here, it says, Remarkable, it's the thing you'll do today that will inspire others. It's the thing you'll attempt today that will surprise even yourself. Remarkable is choosing to give when others take. It's choosing to notice what others overlook. It's choosing to engage when everybody else just walks right on by. And so the challenges are crafted in such a way that it's very specific. We lay it all out. You don't have to give it a whole lot of thought. It tells you exactly what you need to do. It gives you some options. And it's so easy to do. But the fun part about it is you'll immediately see a huge positive wake that you make in your world, and you'll bless someone else's life as a result of it. And you, in turn, will be blessed. Because one of the things that we talk about in the book is the fact that all things positive in life are the byproduct of creating value. And so many of us pursue the wrong things. We pursue fulfillment, happiness, success. But how do you know when you've ever reached that? I mean, have you ever tried to do anything to be happy?
Yeah, it's a journey. It's what you do every day.
It's creating value for others. We're fulfilled and happy when we bring more to the table than we take away.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you bringing that today. I'm going to accept that challenge. So tomorrow morning, I'll open up my envelope and really appreciate you coming to talk to us today. Your website, if someone wanted to have you come in and work with their organization, do they get to you through Remarkable Movement, or is there another way that they would connect with you?
Well, thanks for asking. In two ways, either through RemarkableMovement.com or our corporate website is CreateRemarkable.com.
Right.
So if you want to create Remarkable, and if you want to continue the conversation about how to do that, we're more than happy to engage you in that process.
So I always ask my guests as a closing question, and to get a little bit of, again, more insight about you, is if knowing what you know today about being remarkable, if you were talking to your 20-year-old self, what would you tell them?
That happiness, fulfillment, and success comes from doing things for others. And that in life, everything around us tells us to take care of number one first. That we ask ourselves 1,000 ways every single day, what's in this for me? And if we could change that and ask ourselves this question, what's in this for we, even though that's grammatically incorrect, what's in this for all of us? How can we make this a win-win? How can we bless other people while at the same time we meet our own goals and objectives? In other words, we don't take advantage of people. We don't compete with others, but we collaborate and work effectively together to produce something of benefit for all of us. Then life is really, really good. And we find ourselves then being value creators and not just value extractors.
Great. Well, I thank you for coming in and talking to us today. And join us next week when we have another broadcast of Growth Matters right here, Fridays at 10. So let's talk about it, because
growth matters.